You are listening to WMRW-LP, broadcasting out of Warren, Vermont at 94.5 FM and streaming live at WMRW.org. The following program presents the views of its participants and producers. It does not necessarily represent the views of WMRW or its license holder, RootsWork. Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to the 5H Show, and the 5Hs stand for health, happiness, harmony, humor, and humanity. And today is September 15th, 2024, and my name is Amy, and I am live in the studio here today, and I am going to have a guest calling in here any moment. And my guest today, I'm really excited. I've been working for months to bring on the pastor, Ed Wheeler, from Middlebury, Vermont. And he has been a pastor for, oh gosh, it looks like about 16 years. He was also a business owner for about 15 years. He's an electrical engineer. He was delegate at the Republican National Convention. But he is also bipartisan. And he is also interested in election integrity. And he is very interested in things like science and history. And where did I meet Ed Wheeler? Well, I met him at a rally at the State House that probably none of you out there have heard of because it was censored by all media, apparently. And so here at WMRW, we invite everybody. Here he is. Hold on one second. Hello, Ed. Oh, good. Hi there. One second. I'm going to push a couple buttons and bring you up, okay? Perfect timing, right on cue. Hold on a second. Hello, Ed?
Yes.
Oh, fantastic. Good afternoon here. Let me bring the music down. Wonderful. I just did a little introduction for you.
Okay, and I did not hear that. So I you want to give me a little idea what you said?
Yeah, sure. Yep, definitely. I was letting folks know that you are a pastor, you've been a business owner, an electrical engineer, a delegate at the RNC, and I was just starting to explain where we met at the rally there at the State House in June. Or was it
okay,
May?
Good.
I think it was May.
Right. All right. Well, okay. So I think that, if you don't mind, I'll just go ahead and spiel on and jump in and ask me questions or something at any point.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Fantastic.
So I am a pastor here in East Middlebury, Vermont. It's the church is Valley Bible Church. I've been here for over 16 years now, and so that's a big part of my life. But it reminds me, as I was thinking about this, that actually I'm a dual citizen. I'm a citizen of heaven because I've made Jesus Christ my Lord and Savior. I've learned what that means. That's eternal life, and that's just a huge thing to be a citizen of heaven. I hope everybody joins me in that. But I'm also a citizen of one of the greatest, if not the greatest country in the history of the world, the United States of America. And that citizenship in each case involves a lot of privilege, a lot of tremendous blessings and good things, and it also implies a lot of responsibility. So I have, you know, the dual citizenship, and I want to be faithful to both of those truths. So that's how, you know, I view my involvement in these different things. So when I talk about my country, I'm not a pastor, I'm a citizen. And that gives me a lot of rights and privileges and a lot of responsibility. So one of the things I try to understand what's going on, I've studied a lot about the current situation in our country and the changes that are taking place, and it's not just a random thing, not just a thing of people being lazy or ignorant or something like this, but there's actually a contest between very committed people, and it's a contest between two worldviews or philosophies, two approaches to life. The one I call Americanism, and the other one is Marxism. And Americanism is the Judeo-Christian worldview on which the United States was founded. So it's displayed, it's preserved in our Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution. And so this was our foundation. I think you've been talking about Abraham Lincoln, and I found something very recently how he described these two documents. He said that the Constitution is like a silver frame, and not just like a frame of a picture, but a three-dimensional frame, or like picture it like a pavilion or a building that's protecting something. And inside that silver frame is a gold apple, and the golden apple is the Declaration of Independence. So the Declaration of Independence has all of the principles and values that define Americanism, and the Constitution is the legal framework that's built around it to protect those values and principles. So that's the way our country was started. That's the way our country functioned for a long time. But in the last century, especially the last 100 or a little more years, it's been challenged by a completely different approach, which is Marxism. And Marxism actually was around long before Karl Marx was born, but it's an easy handle to describe it. It's the atheistic worldview that relies on really human conflict to accomplish socioeconomic progress. So it's it leaves God out of the picture, and there's only people and only the material world. And so that's challenged the original Americanism that our country was founded on. And so that's and very aggressively they haven't been that quiet about it. So in the way I like to look at this now, I've identified 10 areas of a concern, 10 components of a worldview, really, and I compare Americanism and Marxism along those 10 concerns or properties. So I'll go through it real fast. For Americanism, the ultimate reality is God. And the spiritual world is the ultimate reality. This physical world is just a reflection. It's something that God has created. And but that world has a conflict, too, because there's a satanic component operating. But that's ultimate reality, is that conflict between God and Satan. Our morality is the Judeo-Christian biblical standards. And a healthy society is many institutions like the family, religious institutions, business institution, and educational institutions, all functioning on their own, independent of the government. The government may have some protective role or something like that, but it should not be governing these other institutions. And then there's individual freedom, and that's people being free to choose their own destiny. Number five would be individual expression of art. That means that art should reflect the beauty of God and creation. Then government, what's the function of government? Well, ultimately, it's of, by, and for the people themselves. It's self-government, an experiment, which I'll maybe come back to here in a minute. But then number seven, order and cooperation are what leads to progress and prosperity in our society. Number eight, a free exchange of ideas and viewpoints is what, again, leads us into greater and greater truth. And then nine, a minimum number of laws. The government should be strictly enforcing but a minimum number of laws and impartially enforcing them. And then finally, the freedom of the individual to keep and bear arms. Okay, now the contrast with that is Marxism, where ultimate reality is the physical universe. There is no God, there's no spiritual world, there's just the material. It's a form of atheism. And morality is whatever advances the revolution or the party. Number three, a healthy society would be an equal outcome or equity between all citizens. And it comes about by conflict, as we sense it. So something like the idea of evolution, of survival of the fittest. And then individual freedom is restricted to whatever the party deems and defines as good. And individual expression or art has to support the revolution. It should not be, there's no standard of beauty apart from that. Then the government is of, by, and for the revolutionary party. Progress and prosperity result from conflict, not from cooperation. And free exchange of ideas is very restricted only to the viewpoints that the government approves of. And they want a profuse number of totalitarian laws, that so many laws and so confusing that no one can even know them all, and or much less obey them all, so that those laws can be used to control people, and they're applied in a very uneven way. And then finally, only the state can keep and bear arms. Now, no one is 100% pure in their Americanism or Marxism. We all tend to be like an amalgam, because we've had both these influences in our lives as growing up here in America. So that but you can go through those 10 components and sort of measure yourself. Do I come out more on the Americanist side or more on the Marxism side? So that's just a little introduction to, a course that I've been conducting all over the state. We take a whole day and we go through these things and we explore the roots of all these ideas and where they come from. Do you have any comment at that point, Amy?
Yeah, thank you. I was really interested to hear about how you had gone around the state. That was exactly going to be my first question for you, was how did that go? You went around presenting this course, Americanism versus Marxism. What were the reactions and what did people think?
I think people appreciated it a lot. I'm still doing that, by the way, especially after this election season. I want to go around and continue to offer this, because it's an evolving situation, of course, depending on what happens. But I think that the principles here, it helps to simplify, it helps people to understand what's going on. Sometimes people will talk about Marxism, well, that's bad and all this, but what's really the alternative to Marxism? People don't even know. They can't articulate this, the idea of Americanism. And all these principles, the 10 things I'm talking about, they come straight out of the Declaration of Independence. You can go right back to that. And, of course, the inspiration for that was the Bible. The nice thing about the Declaration of Independence is that it's the foundational law of the United States. It's the declaration that made us a country. And without that, we have no legitimacy as a country. So that's why I fall back on that rather than talking about the Bible itself. We can go right to that and get a lot of these principles and values that define us as a people and that we need so desperately. And of course, these things are not being taught in our schools. That's one of the real tragedies. It should be required from a young age. All the kids learn of that Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. But of course, the Marxists don't want this. They don't want anybody. I was just reading about it. 41 states, they've made it unnecessary or even banned to teach cursive writing, because these old, a lot of, like the Declaration of Independence, it's in a cursive form of English, so kids won't even be able to read the original documents.
Right. Oh, yes. And thank you so much. I'm speaking today with Pastor Ed Wheeler, and I was actually just ruminating on, you know, what could we talk about when you came on the show? And what kept coming up for me was just how, you know, the spiritual crisis that so many of us are finding ourselves in, facing, you know, the despair of either feeling so silenced and left out of the debate, you know, but then also people seem also equally in despair because they want to silence the debate. And it's very frustrating to them that these other voices keep trying to get in on it. And that's why I think it's really starting with education seems like a brilliant way to do that, to bring us all back to the origins of the Declaration of Independence, that we are all equal, that our voices and our ideas need to bounce off of each other.
That's right. We need that give and take, open discussion, which, of course, again, the Marxists don't want. And they've been working for over 100 years on their, and they've been working hard, and they've been very successful. I congratulate them very much. They've been very successful. And they've learned how to take the taxpayers of the people of America to destroy America. And they're very close to succeeding. Now, my own personal prayer and hope is that 2024, this year, will be the high watermark of Marxism in America, because enough people will wake up, instead of just drifting along and not really paying attention and not understanding. They will wake up to what's happening, and we will begin to reverse it.
Right. It does feel like things are going so far afield. And it's really easy for people to get distracted by, you know, the concepts, the specifics that they have us all, bickering over. Things like, you know, CO2 and carbon and climate change and abortion and, you know, all of these subjects, gun control. But really, you know, we need to be sharing notes here. And so I really appreciate, Ed, that you not only appreciate the spiritual and the historical aspects, but also the science. Like, you're a pretty strict science guy.
That is true. And since you brought it up, I have some notes here about the climate in particular. I mean, this is a spectacular example of political propaganda being used to brainwash a whole society, including, you know, many people with PhDs and things like this. They just blindly follow this idea that there's too much CO2 in our atmosphere. And that, scientifically, that is an absurd idea. And I'll explain why. Right now, people might claim there's like 400 or a little more than 400 parts per million in our atmosphere is CO2. And they consider that some kind of catastrophic thing. But if you think about it, it's, let's say it went to 500 parts per million. So I want everyone to visualize, let's say, a very large field of people, as 1 million people out there. And out of the 1 million, 500 represent CO2. Well, that's just a smattering. It's a tiny, tiny fraction of that total, but that's what we're talking about. And if you divide a million by 500, you get 2,000. So another way to visualize this, which I've done, I have a handout for this. Imagine dots. There's an array of dots. It's 50 dots wide and 40 dots up and down. So that makes 2,000. Out of that 2,000 dots, one will be CO2. Now, you can ask anybody that's, say, a proponent of global warming, concern, how does that one component, that one dot, affect the temperature of the entire thing? It cannot. CO2 has no special properties that would even begin to do this. Meanwhile, every single plant on planet Earth, every bush, every blade of grass, every tree must have CO2. If we dropped any lower, how is anything going to live? We all die. So the fact of it is, Amy, we could easily double the concentration of CO2 in our atmosphere, and the Earth would benefit greatly. There would be no negative consequences whatsoever. But people are scared to death. They think that the exhaust of their car or their cows are somehow affecting global warming. It is not.
I know, and I think that's the saddest part. That's what started to wake me up was, you know, I grew up really believing all of that and owning that and feeling like, you know, I was guilty of hurting the planet. But I wasn't really aware of how it was affecting me until I started to see how it affects kids to grow up in that kind of a world, you know, frame of things.
Right. They're afraid and they're, you know, insecure. It's a real crime against humanity to teach our children this. And I've got some other things here about this. First of all, it's absurd and it's inhumane. The goals that Vermont has set, for example, are completely impossible to reach, and they're not necessary anyway. If you could reach them, it wouldn't make any difference in our climate components. The things that have been happening will just continue to happen. And I've already mentioned, if we doubled the output of CO2, if we doubled the concentration, the Earth would just, more things would grow faster. This is what they do in plant nurseries. If they inject CO2, so instead of 400 or so parts per million, they go up to 700 or 800 parts per million. The plants grow faster. They grow more healthy. It's a fantastic boost. And that's what we would get on planet Earth. Everything would grow faster, all our vegetation. So we would benefit. And another thing is, even if we did go to net zero, it would not make it. Again, the proportion of CO2 would be so small, you wouldn't notice any difference. And also, this trying to replace our petroleum fuels with wind and solar, which we're doing in spades here in Vermont, is just fueling China. And they have a lot of inhumane operations going on, like in Africa. They're using slave labor and child labor in places like Africa and Afghanistan to mine cobalt. And things like this components, which they use for electric batteries back in China. That's all being, you know, encouraged and sort of promoted by this crazy idea of too much CO2. And so we're destroying our economies for no reason. Of course, the Russians, the Chinese, the Indian governments all know that this is bogus. They're not doing anything on it, and they actually should not for their own good. So it's only the Western economies. This is a move that Marxism has made to bring down our economies. The severe weather events, they haven't increased, like they say. We had more hurricanes back in the 50s than we are having now. So all of this is just completely made up. And the other thing, as I indicated, CO2 is such a small part of the atmosphere. No one's ever come up with any kind of a real mechanism how it could affect temperature, but they'll talk about climate models related to CO2. And what they mean are statistical models where they're trying to make some kind of a correlation between the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere and temperature. Of course, and even that does not work. The temperature goes down when CO2 comes up. And the temperature itself, when it does rise for whatever reason, it causes much more CO2 to come out of the ocean. So then the CO2 lags the temperature rather than the other way around. So that's the only kind of, and the models that they come up, these statistical models actually are often contradicted in this International Protocol for Climate Change. They'll put out these reports every once in a while. If you go back and read the details of the reports, you realize they don't support the idea of global warming. But the executive summary in the beginning, which the governments all read, that will say that this is somehow substantiating their claims of global warming, which in fact it does not do. So here's another thing. If we got rid of all petroleum processing, it would create unimaginable human suffering because more than 6,000 common vital manufactured products are derived from petroleum fuel production byproducts. So as we're making gasoline and diesel fuel, there are many byproducts of that that we use to make plastic and all kinds of other consumer goods and medical equipment. And that would go away if we stopped extracting petroleum from the earth. So, I mean, the whole thing is just almost unimaginable how this has been foisted on us.
Yeah, I recently came across this movie. It came out in 2023. It's called Climate, the Movie, The Cold Truth. And it breaks down a lot of these graphs and models that you're talking about and comparing it with the mathematical, statistical things that they're coming up with, and then what the IPCC's actual evidence. I keep finding that over and over again, that the evidence these organizations have, if you actually read it for yourself, there's nothing in there to support their claims. And so I love what you said at the rally. You said settled science is actually really settled silence. It's a way of silencing.
Yeah, that's what they want. They want settled silence. They want us to shut up. Don't ask any questions. Just listen to what we're telling you and you know, be good little comrades.
Right. And the name calling, right, to get people to be quiet, and the censorship. And so you gave a challenge at the rally. You said, I challenge any expert to show the physics. And I've been listening really carefully to these experts for decades. And you're right. They can never explain the actual physics. There really is
right.
No explanation for it. So what do you think about a coming together? Is it going to be possible for us, maybe not to all agree, but at least to come together and compare notes in some kind of a fair format? I feel like both sides of the issue, people are really chomping at the bit to have the conversation.
I think so. You know, when we live in a time of miraculous communication, I'm speaking with you right now. We can take this conversation and make it available to thousands or even millions of people. It can go around the world. I mean, it's an amazing thing. So, and I believe in that the truth does prevail. People are attracted to the truth. They are attracted to light when it's available.
Yeah. Yeah. And, these dirty little secrets that people tend to ignore or not even be aware of, such as the continued slavery or enslavement of people to produce these products, is something that really needs some light shed on. But you said that these mm-hmm. goals that Vermont is working on, you know, to address CO2 are unnecessary, right? So that's where the science. But then you also talked about how unachievable they are. Do you want to say a little bit about that?
Well, even the people in charge of this program for trying to carry out the Global Warming Solutions Act fully admit that these goals cannot be achieved. And the way the law is written, then any citizen can then challenge the government, sue the government for not reaching the goals, and the government has to pick up the legal costs of the challenges. So, I mean, it's a formula for complete disaster here in Vermont. And the fuel prices are about to go through the roof. Imagine heating oil increasing, in addition to whatever it costs now, another $2 to $3 per gallon. And the law is written in such a convoluted way that they have to have the fuel dealers, the people selling the fuel, they have to calculate how much carbon. What carbon, additional carbon is being added and add a cost to the fuel based on that. And it's so difficult to calculate. They can't even do it. And then to insure it or to administer this and to watch it, they estimate here in Vermont will cost $40 million a year just in the administrative costs for trying to bring this about. And it will fail anyway.
Wow.
But we don't have the power. So this is all, unless the law gets repealed, this is what we're heading for.
Right. Right. Wow. So thank you. Today I am speaking with Pastor Ed Wheeler from East Middlebury, Vermont. He's a pastor, a business owner, electrical engineer. And we are speaking of ways that through, you know, bipartisanship of humans coming together in the spirit of the Declaration of Independence, what can be done to kind of heal this divide in our country?
Well, people have to be interested, you know. I want people to be able to see ahead a little bit. You know, this is all going to get worse the way it's dialed into the system right now. And people should not be passive. They should demand answers, and they should get involved themselves and not just hide. This is where the citizenship comes in, the responsibility of citizens. And it's been neglected. And this is another thing I talk a lot about in this course. You know, our ancestors, they gave us a very open system, and it was meant for everyone to be involved. So the way it works here in Vermont, we've got two major political parties. You can choose either one. I don't care which one you choose. I really don't. As long as you as a citizen go in there and advocate for these principles of Americanism. So you should go to your town meeting. Your organizational meeting every 2 years, they organize, go and find other people in your town that you trust and that you agree with, and get them elected to the county committee. And then whoever goes to that county committee, again, they find the best people among them to go to the state committee. That's how it's supposed to function. But what's happening? Nobody goes, even to the town committee. It's hard. I live in a fairly big town. It's hard to get more than 5 people to that meeting. It should be 500 people minimum.
Yeah.
And that's the beginning of the problem right there. There's not enough interest. Some people have given up, and other people are just plain lazy.
Right. That's why I love having people like you on the show, because they're here in Vermont. We actually do have an abundance of folks who are putting their muscle behind these problems. It's just you're not getting much press. You're not, you know, it's people aren't necessarily hearing about what's going on. But people are waking up. And I love your emphasis on that, because, you know, we are the ones who need to do something about this. And if we spent, like
Correct.
You said at the rally, if we spent as much time on our citizen engagement as we do on our favorite hobby or sports team, imagine what would happen.
That's right. You see, people, we've been lulled into some kind of stupor, and people sort of imagine, well, somebody else will take care of this. No, there is no somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
We're the citizens. We are the ones. And if we don't get involved, then some very bad actors will come in and monopolize the whole thing. That's exactly what has happened to us. Now, another thing I talk a lot about is the Communist Party for a long time has had 45 major goals for America. I don't know if you've run into that. It was published in the Congressional Record in 1963, so it was around a long time before that. And they lay out their plans to invade the churches, invade the educational institutions, invade the political parties, and they did it. So we can look back and see how, you know, they've been so successful, and they have, and nobody stood in their way really in any appreciable degree. You know what the first obstacle, of course, is Christianity. And in fact, I recently ran into a really good quote about this. I'm going to grab it here fast. This is Antonio Gramsci, who was one of the modern Marxists. He came up with the idea, instead of just economic Marxism, we should have cultural Marxism. So he was writing about this. This is back in, like, I think, 1919. He said, socialism is precisely the religion that must overwhelm Christianity in the new order. Socialism will triumph by first capturing the culture via infiltration of schools, universities, churches, and the media by transforming the consciousness of society. And George Soros and people like him have picked up that ball. And that's what they've been doing. They've been investing millions and millions of dollars. And you know what the very first front organization, communist front organization in the United States was?
What?
And it was established in 1912. So before World War One, before the Soviet Union was created or anything, they were already at work. And it was the Methodist Society for Social Advancement, something like that. It was in the Methodist Church. They realized that these big denominations were the thing that was standing in the way of selling communism to Americans. So they went in and they subverted a lot of these big denominations, including the Roman Catholic Church. They recruited people who would go undercover and eventually become in positions of authority in the Roman Catholic Church and turn it from a spiritual organization meant to create, you know, and to sustain people who were serving God into a social organization that would then just be transformed into part of the government. So that you know, they pulled it off. But it's not too late to stop it. That's as long as we have our Declaration of Independence and our Constitution, we can very quickly, again, because of the communication revolution and things like that, if enough people wake up, we can easily turn it back. All the institutions are still intact. We can still rescue our country.
I know. I do love that, you know, all we really need to do is remember, you know, the origins and remember what we have, the tools in our tool bag, that we're all created equal. We all have a right to say things. And then the Declaration of Independence also points out that it's not until it becomes super uncomfortable that people are really, you know, it's against our nature to act until we're really, really pressed into a corner. So I guess
right.
We're there now, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. That is my prayer, my hope. Another thing we could talk about is the elections.
Yes.
And recently we had Dr. Douglas Frank and some others here in the state that were working on this. And one of the big problems with our elections is when in the 1990s we started to use computers to process election results. And that was a big mistake. A lot of the European countries, including like France, they don't use computers at all. They do all hand counting on the precinct level. Both parties are there watching and counting the ballots, and then they tabulate them right there, add it up right on the spot in the local place, and then send the results into the central. They can do it in one day. They have 80 million people. They, you know, it's not a problem. Here's the problem. When you use these machines, all electronic voting machines are computers. They're usually just a fancy personal computer where they put some special packaging on it and stuff. Second, all computers are internet connectable and hackable.
Hmm.
And there's the problem. Any port or removable media of components of the computer can then be abuse, and you can introduce hidden routines and programs into that computer so that it doesn't work the way you thought it was going to work or the way it was supposed to. And three, therefore, all voting machines are hackable, vulnerable, and unreliable for election integrity. And four, only paper ballots cast, collected, and counted on the precinct level and stored custodially can result in valid elections. So we need small voting centers like precincts, even in your cities like Burlington, you'd need a lot of these where we have maybe 1,000 people voting at that one place. And right on the spot, you've got people from all the major parties there watching. They can review, they can count the ballots right there, confirm that it's accurate, and also preserve those ballots so they can come back and be looked at again. And then they send the results to Montpelier. That will be a valid, transparent election. As soon as you put that piece of paper in that machine, nobody can see what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been proven that there's a movie, a very good movie I recommend all the listeners. It's called Kill Chain, the documentary. It was an HBO movie. It was made in 2017, and it explains and illustrates very vividly why what I just said is true. And they take the machines that were being used at that time, and they put a bunch of hackers in a room with them, and they can hack them all within minutes. They're bypassing all the supposed safeguards. Now, the important thing is this exercise was repeated again in July of this year at the DEFCON summit. DEFCON is an annual conference of computer hackers. It takes place in Las Vegas every year. So they did it again. They got all the machines from around the country this year, and they hacked them all.
Wow. Wow. So if we can return to our, you know, founding principles, but not our institutions, apparently, not even voting. I mean, what are we going to do about that? Is there a movement to return to paper voting again?
Yes, there is. And even President Trump has talked about this. And the same people that I'm referring to here have taught him this. And so he is very much in favor of it. And of course, there's no time this year to get this done. Mm-hmm. So we have to try, hopefully, get the right people in office in 2024. And then one of the first things we should do by the next election, big election, we get rid of those computers because they are not reliable. I was using computers in the late 1960s when I was at Johns Hopkins University. So I've been using them for a long time, and I know that this is absolutely true. They're great. They're a great asset to us, but they should not be used for processing elections.
Right. Yeah. You know, I was just talking with a fellow freedom fighter, a friend here, before I came in the station this afternoon, and he was feeling a lot of despair because he was feeling, you know, that it was looking pretty bleak that we were going to get, you know, any real substantial change going on through this election. You know, what can we say to him as far as the light at the end of the tunnel? I mean, if the votes aren't even going to be counted correctly, perhaps, you know, where does that leave folks?
Well, there are limits to what they can do. So if we get enough, the one thing you must do is vote, participate as much as you can. The absolute worst thing you can do, which I've heard some people talk about, well, I'm not going to bother to vote because the system is so corrupt. Well, that's the absolute worst thing you can do. It's like being in a war and you say, well, I'm not going to shoot at you anymore because you're cheating over there.
Yeah, but
what's going to happen in that war? You're going to lose for sure. No, you got to, even if you just got one bullet, you're going to fire it that way. That's the way we have to think about this. And we could overwhelm the system because, see here, they can only cheat to a certain extent. And more people will be watching this year than there were in 2020. I believe that 2020 was completely corrupt. I'll just go ahead and say it. But the people weren't ready for what happened. We now know, in the aftermath, we know that there were lots of areas, big cities here in America, where you had more votes counted than there were people.
Wow.
So we can't allow that to happen again. And that's what they're going to have to do if we have enough people out voting the right way. They can't cheat that much. We have to overwhelm it. And that's what I'm, you know, mm-hmm. praying happens.
And what about exit polls? I mean, 2020, that was difficult, of course, because of COVID and the lockdown and the mail-in voting. Does mail-in voting just kill the validity? Because exit polls were a way of checking, right?
Checking
the count.
Yeah, that's another thing. A major study was done that proved that 25% of all mail-in ballots are fraudulent.
Wow.
So mail-in ballots are a major problem. That's a whole nother avenue of cheating in addition to using computers because these ballots, here in Vermont, I mean, it's crazy. They just send these ballots everywhere. I think my grandson got like five of them at his house or something like that. And and they just shoot them out there, and then anyone can grab those and fill them out and send them in. There's no verification. It's just a free-for-all. So that's another big problem that needs to be eliminated. We don't have the COVID anymore, so there's really no justification. But they're going to do it because of the ability to cheat.
Yeah, I mean, I was almost trying to cheer my friend up by reassuring him that, well, maybe less people participating in the process means more people, you know, are questioning the process and the validity of it. And maybe that can
lead
to some...
That's the wrong conclusion. Yeah, that is the wrong, you know, just because you know there's problems, which I am pointing out, does not mean you should not participate. Participate as much as you can. And there's a big debate about whether you should vote early or vote on election day. And I'm coming down to a compromise where I'm going to go in like a couple of days before election day and put in my ballot. But if you vote too early, then they know how much to rig the computers to overwhelm it. But on the other hand, if you wait until election day and we have a snowstorm, you know, you might not be able to get to the poll or something like that. You know, you slip on a banana peel or something like that, you know, and you don't make it. So that's where I'm coming down on that myself. But we've got to participate.
Yeah, excellent. And not to hang all our hat, you know, our hat on that one thing. You know, I do get frustrated when people only vote and don't get involved the other 306 or whatever, the rest of the days.
Right. That's what we're
years.
Talking about. Go to your town meeting. Go to your town meeting. Find good people. If to go to the county level or yourself or somebody like you, get all your friends and go to that town organizational meeting. That is the beginning of the participation. Like you say, voting is sort of minimal, even though a lot of people don't do it. That's very minimal. You need to be involved. And it starts with those town meetings.
Right, which the town meeting model we have here in Vermont is so fantastic. I feel
it's very good.
Yeah, it's very healing, bringing people in the room together for a meal and for a meeting who don't see, you know, don't agree on all the specifics. But can really find where they do have things in common. And that's kind of where I'm aiming with all of these interviews, is I really would love to see more formats where people can come together, because I think you're right. People are attracted to the truth. And at the same time, it can be dangerous to tell the truth, and it's hard to get the truth out there. Yeah, playing on that idea that we're all equal, I'm trying to get folks from different points of view to come together and be willing to hear from each other. Like, what if we did a couple of panel discussions, you know, one on climate change, and just really bring people with the real science in the room to kind of talk it out.
Whenever I hear that, I go running.
Oh yeah,
to it.
Yo, running to it. Great. Oh, good.
To it. Yeah, I want to be there. I want to show them my grid of the 2,000 dots, one being CO2, and get them to explain to me how that can possibly be controlling temperature.
Right.
That's what happens if I go to one of those forums you're talking about.
Yes, wouldn't it
and
be
anyone I know about, I'll be there.
Because I've been talking with a friend of mine who's coming very, very strictly from the liberal point of view. And he did email me in response to some videos I sent him and information. And I said, you know, don't we all have the right to our own opinions? I just want to read what he said in response. He said that while we all have a right to our opinions, we do not have a right to our own facts. In a pluralistic society, as in any community, opinions should at some level be supported by facts. And so he's coming
Amen.
From
the,
right. I mean, I think we agree, right, on that.
Right, we do. Except, he thinks the facts are on his side, but they aren't.
Right, and he would say the same of you, right? And so wouldn't this be a really great conversation, you know, with some really great ground rules? We could talk about what's quality science and agree on these things before we come together. And in the spirit of, you know, Abe Lincoln, it's not so much, you know, that one's going to win and one's going to lose and have the glory and the loss. But where can we come together? You know, because that's
okay,
really where
yep.
we all evolve, right?
Let me know when and where.
Excellent. Excellent. And what about, I don't know if I've ever heard you speak on this subject, but what about the subject of abortion? I thought that you'd maybe have the heart and from your experience as a pastor dealing with sensitive subjects. That's right. One that really is divisive as well. And needs some healing big time and some light shed.
So as a Christian, as a citizen of heaven, I have to say that as soon as that little human being is formed in the womb, before anybody even knows it's there, that is a person in God's eyes. And it's an enormously immoral to willfully destroy that. At the same time, so this is my stance from the moral standpoint. And we need to promote that. We need to get that idea out there. To me, it's just as morally outrageous as slavery. Slavery is morally outrageous, and it was tolerated in our country way too long. It needed to be eradicated, and thank God it did get eradicated. You can't run for office and say, well, I think slavery wasn't all that bad. I'm morally opposed, but but we have to tolerate in our laws. No, it's not to be tolerated. And that's how I feel from a personal standpoint. At the same time, I have to realize that in the now as a citizen of the United States, I have to realize a lot of my citizens don't understand that yet. And so I have to compromise. You know, there's compromise in the political arena that I do not have in the spiritual arena. Mm-hmm. So I am willing to work with people. If we agree on many other things, but we don't agree on that point, I'm still willing to work with them. And I will be willing to work with them in order to stop much more outrageous evil from taking over our country.
Yeah, I did have Greg Thayer on the show a few episodes ago, and he was running for lieutenant governor, and he did explain that sort of softening of the Republican stance on that, to be more inclusive and acknowledging that this is not where all the citizens are at. But it
right.
really, it does.
We have to ramp up our understanding of getting other people to understand this. And it's not the end of the world to have a baby.
Right. And again, just like I love that you use the slavery parallel there, because it is a question of where does the Constitution apply? Who's a person? And that was what mm-hmm. Roe v. Wade was about, right? Was the federal government had set a standard that up to so many months, abortion would be legal. And then after so many months, now this fetus is a person with constitutional rights. And kind of by throwing it back to the states, I'm seeing such a reversal here. You know, the Republicans during the Civil War were fighting slavery. You know, they wanted to abolish slavery. That's who Lincoln was a Republican. And he was
correct.
For federal rule, though, right? Not states' rights. And so over the centuries, it's just wild how things have morphed into,
yeah.
You know, now there's so many differences in where the Republican and Democratic Party land.
Oh, I want more people to understand how morally outrageous it is. And when more than half the people clearly understand that, the appropriate laws will come into effect. But for now, I know, especially in this state, there's too many people that don't share that view. So we still have to work together. We still have to do other good things. So we can't be absolutist until we agree on it. So we have to get together and talk about this. And you know, here's the thing. When does it become a human being? And who has the right to say that that's a human being or not a human being? And I have a lot of people that tell me, well, I don't know. Well, if you don't know, that means you have to assume that it is a human being. And I'll sort of wrap up here with this. Let's suppose you're hunting. We got a lot of deer hunters here in Vermont, and you're out hunting, and you see something in the woods, and it might be a deer, or it might be a child.
Mm-hmm.
Is it okay to pull the trigger?
Yeah.
And then you shoot a child. But you tell the police, well, I didn't know it was a child. I thought it might be a child, but I didn't know it was a child, so it was okay to shoot it. No, it's not okay. As soon as you know that that might be a child, it is wrong to pull that trigger. So with a child in the womb, if you even admit that that might be a child, it is wrong to pull that trigger.
Wow, thank you. Thank you. I'm speaking today with Pastor Ed Wheeler from East Middlebury, Vermont. And
right.
And I do feel like we need some spiritual guidance here in the midst of all this turmoil in our country. I feel like we're being so driven apart. And so I think coming together for these conversations could be very healing. What are some things that you're seeing folks struggling with, and what are some ways that you've been able to help them through these times?
Okay, well, we know, we've read the end of the story, which is in Revelation, that Jesus will come back to planet Earth, and that all the rights, all the things that have gone wrong will be made right again, that perfect justice will be established. And I don't know what's going to happen to the United States, but eventually it will end and the kingdom of God will take over. But the way I look at that, and this is why I teach people, is look, we're responsible for this generation now. The United States, we don't know what will happen in the future, but right now we have a chance to make a difference and to make it better than it would have been. So we need to get involved in that way. And then we trust in God. That's on every piece of currency in the United States. In God we trust. And that means something to me. To me, God, he's not just an idea, not just a concept, not just a philosophy. He's here. He's more powerful than all the governments in the world put together. Just think about that.
Excellent. Yeah, that some force greater than us has our back and has a plan, and that we're all part of it. You know, good,
right,
bad, indifferent, even our mistakes, even our neighbors who we don't agree with are part of it. That's where I get my faith. Yeah.
He loves them, and we have to love them.
Yeah. That's all we have to do. I know. Where can we find the love for each other? I'm really, really interested in that.
Right. I agree with that.
Yeah, well,
it comes from God himself.
Yeah. Yeah, well, thank you, Ed, for sharing your inspiration with us today. How can folks get a hold of you? Like, let's say they would like to invite the Americanism-Marxism course to their community, or they would just like to speak with you further.
Okay, well, I have an email, Ed Wheeler, and then the digit 4, and the word health, @AOL.com.
Ed Wheeler, the digit 4, and then health @AOL.com.
Yes.
I love that. Health, that is one of our 4 H's here, and we are definitely 5 H's.
That's right.
Celebrating.
That's right. I noticed that. Yes. We want health in all the different dimensions.
Yes. Hallelujah to that.
And thank you for your role in that, Amy.
Yes. Thank you.
And thanks for being here. I really enjoyed this time.
Yes.
And people are welcome to ask me questions or let me know when the next climate forum comes up and things like that.
Definitely. I will definitely be in touch about that. There are a lot of ways we can play together in the future and make it more enjoyable for everybody. Make us feel more supported by our neighbors, you know, and less distanced from them. Yeah.
Very good. Thank you, Amy.
Yeah, thank you. All right, folks. Thank you, Ed. We've been here on the 5-H show today on September 15th, 2024. If you would like to hear this episode again, or you would like to hear any other previous episodes of the 5-H show, you can find those at amyvt.com. That's Amy like Amy and then VT like Vermont.com. Well, thank you, folks, and thank you, Ed, for reminding me of the treasure of gold in the middle of the frame that Abraham Lincoln talked about, and that is the Declaration of Independence. And we're going to hear a little bit about that here with this shout-out I've got for Ed. It's the Gettysburg Address. Okay, thanks, Ed. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
67 years ago, our fathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation. conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here.